in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. The 2004-2005 season opens with performances by singer Emmylou Harris, family entertainer Dan Zanes, the Barry Shinkoff Foundation's new theatrical piece, Forbidden Christmas, jazz masters Nancy Wilson and Ramsey Lewis, and sitarist Ravi Shankar. Visit KrannertCenter.com for information on the entire season.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, imported foods from Europe, the Middle East, India, and around the world. Food tastings are held every Saturday from 11 to 5. World Harvest Foods, at the intersection of 6th and University Avenue in Champaign, encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
It's 7 minutes past 1 o'clock. The guest we had scheduled to join us in this portion of the program, humorist Tony Hendra, is not able to be with us this afternoon, so we will reschedule that program. In the meantime, we'll go to the archives and we'll broadcast an interview conducted on June 2nd. Of this year. Earlier this month, we talked with Alexandra Fuller. Stay tuned. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. Alexandra Fuller grew up in the midst of the Rhodesian Civil War. She wrote about that in her best-selling memoir, Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, An African Childhood. In her latest book, Scribbling the Cat, Travels with an African Soldier, she travels across southern Africa with a white veteran of the war. Alexandra Fuller is our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. We'll talk with her about her journey with a veteran she calls Kay through Zambia, Zimbabwe, and Mozambique, meeting, in her words, the whole chaotic, poetic mess of people that turned this journey of curiosity into an exploration of life and death and the fear of living and dying and the difficulty of separating love and judgment from passion and duty. Alexandra Fuller was born in England in 1969. In 1972, she moved with her family to a farm in Rhodesia. After the Civil War, the family moved to Malawi, then to Zambia. Alexandra Fuller has two children. She makes her home in Wyoming. Her first book, Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, received several honors. It's now available in paperback. Her new book, Scribbling the Cat, is published by the Penguin Press. Alexandra, good afternoon. Welcome back.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Where are you at the moment?
Actually, I'm in my cabin in Idaho.
Oh, great.
Which is, yeah, it's where I go to escape. it's so beautiful that I actually came here because of the beauty, but now I have to sit in my office with the curtains drawn. Otherwise, I find I'm tempted outside, you know, just to have one last look at the horses.
Yeah.
Nothing gets written.
Well, this will be all over Sardine. And you'll be able to open up those windows, those curtains, and get outside. You've been on quite the tour.
The book tour?
Yeah.
Yes, it's a very interesting thing to be a writer, which is such a, I think by nature you have to do it. At least the kind of thing I write, an absolute solitary confinement, because if I had any thought that I was then going to have to talk about what I was writing about, I would be frozen, I think, in a paroxysm of fear. I must add that taxi drivers from Pakistan and Bosnia and India all over the United States now think that this accent that I have is the authentic Wyoming accent. Because they ask me where I'm from, and I'm too exhausted to really go into the long story, and I just tell them Wyoming, and so they go away thinking that that's how we all speak.
Yeah. Well, you are from the U.S., but really you are from Africa.
Well, you know, there's a great straddling that I've done, and, you know, that my family's done. You know, I'm the fourth generation to live in Africa. My great-grandfather, my grandfather, my mother, and myself, and my daughter was born there. Yet I think that I was the first generation to really break away from those English roots. I was the first one to say that this is home and that I had no idea of England other than a very romantic sort of Beatrix Potter idea of it. And so in a way that caused enormous conflict, because my parents really raised me, I think, to be a child of empire in a way. It's certainly what they fought for. And my mother's devastation, particularly when independence came to Zimbabwe, conflicted hugely with what I was feeling inside, which was this enormous sense of relief and celebration that the war was over. And I really bottled that up inside because it's, you know, one doesn't want to betray one's parents when one's young. But I had, I think, a secret life. In a way, I think that's what makes all writers, is that you're a voyeur, aren't you, of your own life. And that was the beginning of a disconnect that I think made me a writer, because I was aware very suddenly and abruptly and beautifully that I was this new breed of African, that I could rewrite this horror into something whole, perhaps. And then, you know, to be torn again and to now not only straddle that bizarre rift, you know, between England as home and Africa as home, but now to do it in the U.S., I tell my children, by the way, that when we're outside on starry nights here in the Rocky Mountains, that actually the stars are upside down. In the real world, they're the other way up.
After the war, did your parents consider leaving Africa?
There was a brief period of discussion in which after Malawi, not after Zimbabwe, but after Malawi, you know, politically it was very, very difficult for my parents to live there. They jumped from being, you know, the rulers of Rhodesia, if you like, into a country which had been independent since 63, 64. And so that memory of colonialism had been long erased, you know. I mean, of course, it's still there. It's there to this day. It's there in the buildings and the roads and the infrastructure, and it's sort of seeped into the ground, if you like. But it was difficult for them politically, and under Kamuzu Banda, it was an absolute dictator. And I think that after their experience there for 2 years, where we had been employed by Kamuzu Banda, by the president of the country, to run one of his farms, and the oppression of that, which meant that we had a spy living with us in the house, sort of spying on everything we did, that Mum and Dad considered leaving Africa, and that their options were Papua New Guinea, I think, was the alternative. And the other alternatives were Mozambique and Zambia. Those were the places where my dad could get work. You know, by then he was in his 40s. He had done tropical farming all his adult life. Going back to England, they had tried that experiment. They had left Rhodesia briefly in 68, gone back there. I was born in 69. And they hated it. They hated the sort of, I think, dull monotony of it and the safety of it. You know, I think they had found, they really thrive on chaos in a way. And their sort of illogical optimism is perfectly, perfectly primed for a place like Africa, but it's rather loud in a place like England.
Well, at one point in the book, describing Kay, the veteran that you traveled across southern Africa with, you say, "I tried to picture Kay elsewhere and failed."
Yes. You know, I have said to people that if there were 20 of us sitting in a room and Kay walked into that room, oxygen masks would drop from the ceiling. he's an exquisitely powerful human being. I think that was the first thing that struck me about him, is his massive, massive sense of personality. Not just his physical power, which is overwhelming, but this enormous sense of sort of charisma and his incredible ability to survive. But he's honed for survival in very remote places in Africa. And if you transplanted that anywhere else, I do feel as if he would sort of spontaneously combust. He would be somebody who on his report card, it would be written in big black letters, does not play well with others. He's got rules of his own for life and living, and it works where he is. I think anywhere else would be overwhelming. Everywhere that he has traveled outside of Africa, there's been some sort of He's caused international incidences. He went to Turkey as a diver, and before he knew it, he had the Turkish Navy after him because he had swum into a place where you're not supposed to swim, and he's there having a fight with the captain in the Turkish Navy, and you know, Kay's yelling at him, and this guy's armed to the teeth with a gunship, you know, and Kay's got a spear gun. I mean, he is just absolutely impossible to imagine him anywhere else.
Yeah. He looked bulletproof. He looked cathedral. That's how you describe him earlier in the book, Scribbling the Cat.
Yeah.
And already we get a sense that he sounds dangerous. Tell us about that first meeting when you first met him.
Well, I had heard about him. He's something of a legend. Actually, wherever he's been, he's something of a legend. Because he was trained to survive from such an early age, really even before the war, from even as a child, his grandfather would take him on these monstrously long walks herding cattle. You know, I'm talking a few hundred miles this child walked. So by the time he then went through the horrible hazing of boarding school, which anyone who went to a Rhodesian boarding school during those years, legendary hazing that they went through, and then into the army, he was already, he was famous for his ability to defend himself, and that turned into an infamous ability to, people would be attracted to him for fights. And he's tried to sort of get away from that reputation, but it follows him around. And I think the sense of danger, it's a funny thing, because the sense that I had of him almost from the first meeting was that this was a man you certainly wouldn't want to get on the wrong side of. However, if you were in some kind of terrible disaster, he was the person that you would be hoping you were standing next to. A strange mix of being both terribly protective and very, very possessive, but also, could snap on a trigger. And he had, very, very soon after I met him, literally minutes into our meeting, he began to talk about God as if God was sitting around the table with us. God is absolutely an enormous presence in this man's life. However, the feeling that you get when he's speaking about God, he'll say, I have a tremendous fear and respect for the Almighty. And I remember thinking to myself, well, probably the other way around. God's probably quaking in his boots. And he would say to me at times, I don't know why God hasn't let me die yet. He should have let me die. And I would think, well, God probably doesn't want you up there in heaven sort of organizing everything and taking the place over. I mean, he really has a sense of that kind of one-man soldier, one-man army.
Yeah. He told you later, when you were visiting him out at his farm, he told you about his hopes for marrying, for remarrying, for finishing his house in the bush. Mm. And that is in such contrast to that first meeting when, you sort of see this enormous man and he's, he's...
Sense of self-sufficiency.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I think that someone like my father, for instance, who's sort of British descent and has... didn't grow up in Africa, but has become, in a way, African by default. My dad is a man of such self-sufficiency, physical, emotional, spiritual. You really get the sense from my father that he needs no one else. But even with Kay's tremendous ability to survive, one of the other things he did that surprised me on our very first meeting was begin to cry very freely. Almost whenever he talks about God, tears just start running down his cheeks. And there's a great, deep well of brokenness and sadness inside that man. And sometimes it's perilously close to the surface. And I think that his loneliness is part of his sort of disease, if you like, that his part in that war was so involved and so atrocious what they did compared to my father, who just says, you know, we were bumbling around in the jungle hoping that we wouldn't see any, you know, liberation fighters and hoping we wouldn't shoot each other, let alone any, you know, terrorists. Whereas Kay has a loneliness, I think, that comes with having done and seen such terrible things and knowing that there aren't that many people who would be prepared to share that life. And yet, desperately, I think, trying to recreate or create some kind of stability. And for him, that means a woman, a child, a house, you know, the trappings. And it was as if he was building a monument to his hopes in the belief that if he built it, God would send him someone.
Hmm. He said he would put himself last if all that fell into place. Do you believe him?
No. No, again, he is someone that the interesting thing, I think, about Kay was that initially when I met him, I really, like we all want to do, we want to put people in boxes. And I wanted to put him in a box and say, look, this is a wounded soldier. He's racist. He's born-again Christian to try and somehow make a way to live in this world and to make him one-dimensional and hope that by doing that I could understand him. And that was quickly shattered, you know. I've never met someone who talks so much in my life. There were times I remember sort of, especially when we were traveling together in the vehicle, and it would be raining outside, so I'd have to have the window up. I just think, God, I wonder if it would be rude just to cover my ears at this point. And terribly sort of commanding of every situation. So I think that, like all of us, he has a great ability to say one thing and deeply believe another. And yet he really, I think, does believe that he has made so many mistakes in his life that if he were given the chance to, you know, be with someone else, he would try a different pattern. But I think that it would be very difficult fall into that pattern. He constantly said to me that, you know, the problem with you is that you don't believe in God. You're godless. You're godless. He kept saying that to me over and over again. That, you know, if I just had that one thing that he had, which is the same belief in the same God, that I would somehow be fixed or fixable.
Hmm. Yeah. You yourself say that each of you, you and he, are cracked in your own way.
Yeah.
As a child, what did you make of the war, and how do you think about it now? And what did this journey with Kay across Zambia, Zimbabwe, and Mozambique give you?
Well, it's interesting. I think as a child, I accepted war, sort of the weather, you know. It was something that was happening that I had absolutely no control over. I felt in some way, right in the middle of the war, that if I supported it with all my heart and soul, we would win and it would be over. That's what war was about winning and about praying hard enough, you know, and somehow, you know, God would see that we were right and liberation fighters were wrong and that we should have Rhodesia and then we could go back to peace. When I wrote Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, which was the book about growing up in the war, I on purpose tried not to infuse any adult judgment into that book. Because that would have been disingenuous. As a child, you don't really understand why you're fighting. You firmly believe that being white is right. I mean, that's what we were told. I firmly believed the propaganda. And I firmly believed and supported the troops. But as I said earlier, when that crack happened, you know, when independence came, and I was sort of, in a way, born again myself into Africa, that first inkling of doubt came. And the doubt grew and grew and grew, and it splintered after Don't Let's Go to the Dogs came out. Because what I realized was I had written a book from the point of view of the child, and I had taken no responsibility for the things that I had been as a child. And it's not as if you can be one thing until you're 11 years old and then be perfectly born again another thing. I mean, it took me years of sliding between bases, if you like. You know, I could very easily chameleon into being a good little racist Rhodesian, and I could chameleon back into being a good little Zimbabwean, you know, black Zimbabwean. But it was uncomfortable. It was an uncomfortable, shattering way to go through adolescence. My cracks were ones of, I think, guilt and trying to understand who I was and trying to ensure that I didn't bring to my children the propaganda that had grown me as a child. Kay's cracks were far deeper and far more profound and far more complicated. Here was a soldier who had lost the war that he had been fighting for. There had been no truth and reconciliation in Zimbabwe after the war. The war ended and Mugabe said, right, we're all friends together, that's it, finished. These people had very little psychological help after the war. And so watching him try and make sense of the world, I thought, well, maybe if I really understand him, I mean, looking back, what arrogance, but I really did think, well, maybe if I understand him, I could fix my cracks. And perhaps his cracks will be fixed, too, as we travel through, you know, into Mozambique and see where the war was fought. Because a lot of the war actually didn't happen on Zimbabwean soil. I mean, obviously, there was a normal civil unrest, and some of the war splashed over the borders into the edges, but a lot of the atrocities occurred over in Mozambique. Civilians who had fled Rhodesia to get away from the war, as well as terrorists or liberation fighters who were training over there. Of course, it wasn't really until the book was written and I had time to think about it that I thought, there are no cracks that have been healed at all. In fact, the opposite has happened. I've been split completely wide open, and there is no fixing. You can't fix what happens in war. I am just open now. And in a way, that's a very healing thing, much more healing than trying to paint over those cracks. Had I tried to heal those cracks, really, I would be doing it for the rest of my life, as opposed to just saying there is no healing.
One of the epigraphs that you use at the outset of this book is from Plato, "Only the dead have seen the end of war."
Yeah. There, I had said somewhere else in the book that war is not the fault of soldiers, but it becomes their burden. And war is not necessarily always the fault of civilians who get caught up in it, but it becomes their truth. And I use that word loosely. It becomes the thing that they believe in. You now violate the most basic human code, which is thou shalt not kill. And never again will you be able to go into the world trusting anybody, because I think you have seen how easily that thin, thin veneer of civilization can be shattered, and you are reduced to the most barbaric state. And really, you will carry that with you for the rest of your life until you die. And that is the end of that war. The great trick is not to pass on the violence.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Alexandra Fuller. We're talking with her about her book, Scribbling the Cat, Travels with an African Soldier. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener in Urbana on line one. Good afternoon.
Oh, yes, good afternoon. I was interested to hear you, Alexandra, because I'm sort of a generation before you and from another part of Africa, and have never had that experience of sort of spanning the two eras as you. I noticed you slipped between saying terrorists and liberation fighters for the same people. I was taken to East Africa, to Kenya, actually, at the age of four during the Mau Mau. And spent the rest of my developing years in East Africa and then in Southern Africa. And I know, in fact, a lot of Zimbabweans. So it's great to hear that you have sort of worked through everything and committed it to writing. When did you actually leave Africa, or have you permanently left? Or
I left 10 years ago. I have been, you know, I go back 3-4 times a year. So I, you know, certainly sort of keep my toehold in there. One of the, I don't know if I've really ever made the split. I don't know if I ever really can. I think one of the things that I did do, though, was last year I bought myself two corgi puppies as some kind of insurance to stay put somewhere. And this disease of moving on, which my parents were very good at, I don't want to pass that on to my children either. So I said, well, when the corgis snuff it, I'll be free to move again. And the reason why I used terrorists and liberation fighters back and forth is that Kay always referred to them as terrorists or gooks. And I was on the other side saying, well, you know, there's another word for them. And so it's a conscious thing on my part to say, you know, for him, that's his quote unquote truth. And for me, you know, my truth was something more, permeable, I would say.
Well, I mean, my parents now actually live, they had a similar experience to your parents, although they were colonial servants, as they were called in those days, and posted to East Africa in their early working life. They did try to go back to Britain in the 70s, and like your parents, they hated it. They found it so parochial, and they missed the vastness of Africa, and they managed to get another position back in Botswana, and then retired actually to South Africa, and they still live in South Africa. But I must say I didn't have any sort of epiphany until a lot later in life. I went from East Africa to university in South Africa and didn't find it strange. I didn't find it strange until I was in my 20s, I don't think. And much like you said that you as a child, you accepted what you were hearing around you without judgment. And it's interesting how much we are the creatures of our upbringing, and then it takes exposure to other things to rethink.
Yeah, you know, that is such it's such a salient point, and I think that in the West, anyway, my experience has been that people are allowed when they get to 18 to sort of package up their childhood as something they're not responsible for, and yet they go to hours and hours of therapy to work through it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think it's in a way the wrong way of looking at it, because I really do believe that the only way to sort of go to your grave is to be in full possession of your soul when you go. Otherwise, you're going to leave little broken pieces of yourself around, the pieces that you haven't attended to. And the only way to own your soul is to take responsibility for it. And the only way to take responsibility for it is to open it up and try. I mean, I wouldn't say that I've worked through it at all. In a way, I would say that I've opened up the first can of worms and jumped into the first can of worms, and I've swum with the worms. You know, I've really felt it, touched it, and looked at it again. Hard.
Wow.
Wasn't it all easy? And the interesting thing is that I wrote 8 or 9 novels before my first book was published, because I really tried, in a way, to hold on to that tiny veneer that my mother had sort of varnished over the top of everything that was going on. You know, I don't know.
Doris Lessing?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, not Doris Lessing. She was kicked out of Zimbabwe, as you may know.
Yes.
That
yes.
was far too
well, she
racy
was a communist. Yeah, because of her communist leaning.
No, that was far too
I look
too
forward
racy.
To reading your books. I better get off the line. There are bound to be other people wanting to talk to you, but I'm absolutely intrigued. And I formed my roots here and kept my children here, although, you know, the wanderlust and I didn't want them to have to go from place to place. They've been born and raised here, and I wouldn't go to visit my parents in South Africa until after Mandela was freed, so my parents were horrified at that. But they are, I call them sort of dinosaurs. I say they're the last of the dinosaurs. Very different worldview, too. Lovely to hear you. I'm going to continue listening and get some of your books, too.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other questions, comments are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Alexandra Fuller is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She grew up in the midst of the Rhodesian Civil War. She wrote about that in her best-selling memoir, Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight. Her latest book is Scribbling the Cat, Travels with an African Soldier. In this book, she writes about traveling across southern Africa with a white veteran of the Rhodesian Civil War. Before we go too much further here, I think we should talk about this verb scribble. What does it mean?
Well, you know, in any war, you have to remove from your mind the thought that you are killing people. And so the Rhodesians, as all soldiers all over the world have done for time immemorial, used a different, they didn't use the word kill, they would say plug, cal, you know, C-U-L-L, which is what you mm-hmm. cattle. And scribble, and the genesis of scribble is that during the war, if you were killed as a Rhodesian troopie, your name was scribbled out of the book with a pencil so that you weren't getting paid anymore. You know, you were no longer counted. Kay used the word to say, I had a car crash and my car was completely scribbled, which means that his car was a write-off. And it was such an evocative term. He used it so extensively that, in fact, before very long, I nicknamed him Scribbles, and it became a bit of a sort of joke. But the genesis of the word, of course, is quite chilling.
Yeah. And your father told you at one point, curiosity scribbled the cat.
Yeah, warns me.
Yeah.
He warned me, definitely. It, you know, I think my father, again, you see, there's this sense when you live there, that you need, first of all, there's so much that goes on from a day-to-day basis that you need to deal with. The sort of constant low-grade wreckage of just life around you. Our life expectancy in Zambia now is 33. People are constantly ill, constantly dying. There's always one emergency after the other. And so this luxury of looking back, let alone writing about it, I think is seen as quite, first of all, self-indulgent, but secondly, very dangerous, because there is enough to deal with in life without looking back. My parents would be the worst possible candidates for therapy. I can imagine. I would be very amused to take my father into a therapist just to see how long the whole thing would last, but I have a sense not very long.
Hmm. How did your mom cope with it all? Same way your dad did?
With the war, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think that there's this, you know, I used to call it white noise once I began to understand it. Existing in such a loud, noisy world of your own that you can conveniently ignore the fact that 11 million people are being trampled over while you're going about your business. Do you see what I mean?
Mm.
And I think that in order to create or at least exist in that kind of denial, for want of a better word, you have to fervently believe in it in some sense and then drink an awful lot, because if you were ever sober for long enough to realize what you were doing, I think you would see the ridiculousness of your situation. My mother definitely dealt with what was going on with far more passion than my father. She was much, much more involved as a soldier, as a supporter of Rhodesia. She once proudly told me quite recently that during elections in Rhodesia, she voted for someone who was even more right-wing than Ian Smith. I said, I didn't think you could get more right-wing than Ian Smith. And so the war for her, the end of the war for her, was a terrible, shattering, devastation for her. It coincided with the death of her fifth child. She had had five children, and when my youngest brother, Richard, died, she had lost three of the five children. And it was as if she mourned not only the loss of Rhodesia, but her child. So it was a physical mourning. I wrote in Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight that it looked as if she was dissolving with grief. And it was a period of really madness for her. I think that during the whole period during the war, she'd be manic. You know, it wasn't until long after the war, when my son was born, actually, that she was diagnosed with manic depression. And she now says to me, war is the perfect place to be manic depressive, because that entire time I was manic. And the war ended, and suddenly I had nothing left to fight for, and my last baby was dead, and I just slumped into this incredible depression. My father dealt with that by moving on. He said, right, that's it, we're not staying here, let's move. You know, let's give your mother something to think about, give her something to do.
Mm. Your dad gave up guns after the war.
Yeah, he'll never touch another gun.
Yeah.
As long as he lives. Yeah. And that was interesting about, very soon after I got back from this trip, three armed men jumped into my father's vehicle. He was on a sandy road driving very slowly. They had AK-47s. One jumped on the bonnet of the car, and the other two jumped into the cab of the car with him and beat him up with the butts of their guns, but they were too close to him to get a good shot. And they wanted guns and money. Well, I could have told them that my father's never had any money, and he hasn't carried a gun since the end of the war. Anyway, they, bashed him about and left him on the side of the road for dead. But as my father says, it takes more than that to kill an old bugger like me. So he sort of crawled off to the nearest tavern and had 11 brandies and coke. When he told me this, I said, well, you knew you were going to have a headache anyway. Why compound it with 11 brandies and coke? And he said, aha, the trick is, if your hangover is worse than what's just happened to you, you can forgive what's just happened to you. Mm. That's my father's philosophy for you.
It's like hitting your head against the wall. Feels so good once you stop.
Yeah.
I quoted from your note to readers that opens Scribbling the Cat in my introduction, and I want to mention something else from that note. That is, you take note of the significance of story. You say, because when we're all dust and teeth and kicked up bits of skin, when we're dancing with our own skeletons, our words might be all that's left of us.
Yeah. Well, I think in a way it was a way for me to apologize to the people that I write about, because it's difficult, I think, to see yourself portrayed in print. And I have done the unthinkable. I am someone who can go between camps. I have that ability to sort of fly under radar, if you like. I understand these people's language, and I look like them, I sound like them, and I've lived through some of what they've lived through. And so there is a comfort in them telling me their story. And I think that there is an enormous feeling of guilt and discomfort in writing their stories, even though everyone understood that was talking to me that this was going to become a story. Often people will say to me, well, why couldn't you wait until they were dead? Or why couldn't you, especially about the first book, why couldn't you wait until your parents were dead, instead of having to throw your life back at them? I think my answer to that is that our stories are so important, and it's important to tell them while we're still alive, so that we're still around to explain them, so that we're still around to support them, and so that we're still around to pass them on and make sure that they're vibrant and real. Because after all, this is just a tiny snapshot, a minute sliver of a snapshot of what we are as humans on this planet. But it is part of our story as humans.
Mm. At one point in this particular story, you're back. You've been to visit your parents for Christmas, and then you're back in the States for about 10 months, and then you're back in Africa trying to write a story on Zimbabwe in 1,200 words. How do you, as a journalist, as a writer, try and get the best snapshot you can?
I get on the local buses, and I travel across the country with people who are on the move, and people are always on the move. Well, in Zimbabwe, for instance, they're on the move because of fear, because of hunger, because of need. And within that sort of egg of transport, you are all thrown in together. Nobody is more important than the other. You can no longer be a journalist or be sheltered by your American passport or whatever else you have. You're all subject to the same discomfort, and the bus breaks down and you're on the broken down bus. And then the stories begin to flow, and you talk to the person next to you, and you talk to the people when the bus breaks down and the campfire gets built and you sit around and the food is getting shared, and the stories come out, and then you get the story of a country. Mm. You go from border to border, but you travel with the people. And, no, it's not a whole story. Of course it's not. There is no way of telling a whole story in 1,200 words. But it is a way of getting a real sense, I think, of what's happening.
Mm.
Yeah.
Have you talked with journalists who come to Africa for just a short space of time and try to capture the story?
Our conversations tend not to be very long. I think that it is, you know, it's in our nature to attack a place with our preconceptions, because we are human and we need to, it's our, as children, as babies, we try and make sense of where we are based on what we already know. And if you're coming from the West and that's what you know, and you try and put that template on top of Africa, it's not going to look the same as, for instance, my template is, that, you know, I maybe know it from the ground up. And I think what I ended up being impatient with, when I first began to write about Zimbabwe and Mugabe's genocide had only just started, and I was saying, look, this is a genocide, and other journalists were saying, no, this is giving back land to the people. And I said, but you haven't spoken to the people. They are, you know, and then, of course, the truth comes out. But once you've already begun to see the world one way, you want to write it that way. You need your words to make sense of your mind. Do you see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that there are some people who are very gifted at writing about Africa, because from the outside in, I'm thinking of Paul Theroux.
Mm.
One of the reasons why he does it so brilliantly, I think, is that he is suspicious by nature. And he's suspicious not only of everyone he meets, but of his own motivations. He's constantly calling back onto himself the suppositions that he puts on the people that he's writing about.
Mm. He's also able to straddle two worlds, I think.
Several worlds.
Yeah.
Yeah. When he makes his mark, he makes it beautifully. I think that there are lots of Africans who write badly about Africa, because again, it's that sense of coming, you know, where you come from,
mm-hmm.
and suspending judgment. Suspending judgment is a very difficult thing to do, and suspending your preconceptions and your bigotry in whatever way that is. I mean, I've often heard, you know, who are you to write about Africa? You're white. And in a way, it's such a ridiculous thing to say, that my color disables my ability to write. And I think Africa has, it creates such powerful emotions in people, the very word, you know.
Hmm. Also, I think in order to do a good job telling the story of any place, is you have to be able to hear the silences.
Yes.
As you put it in the book, how do you film an absence when you're talking about the people who have died of AIDS and
right.
who have HIV?
Right.
How do you film an absence? How do you record the disappeared?
How do you record the voiceless?
Hmm.
And how I wrote too that, you know, it's traveling through a place depends very much on whether you have to live there or whether you're passing through for a short period of time. And if you have to live there in a place where only the very loud get fed, there is a sense of urgency and desperation. And if you can put yourself, however briefly, into that idea that you aren't looking at the landscape, but the landscape is something that you depend on for food. I think some of that myth and romance would be peeled away, and you would get to the core of some of these issues.
Mm.
Yeah.
And your children, have you taken them to the place where the stars are right side up?
Plenty of times.
Yeah.
Well, you know, my daughter was born there, and then I think my son was three when we first took them back, and we've been back several times. And my sort of dying memory of taking them through Zimbabwe, and the troubles had just begun there, and the petrol had been pushed through from Mozambique, the last of the petrol, using salt water. So the petrol was a bit dodgy, and we're about to break down. It's dark. We're in a quite a dangerous place. and my children are in the back seat singing, "Why, oh, why did we ever leave Wyoming?"
Well, all of Sardine, all of a sudden, the time has flown past. Alexandra, it's been my pleasure talking with you again.
Oh, thank you so much. I've enjoyed this.
Take care. Best to you and your family.
Thank you.
Alexandra Fuller has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author of Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, An African Childhood. Her latest book is Scribbling the Cat, Travels with an African Soldier, the book published by the Penguin Press. And that interview was from June 2nd of this year. Earlier this month, we talked with Alexandra Fuller. Again, the humorist Tony Hendra was unable to be with us this afternoon. That was the interview we had scheduled for today. We will reschedule that interview. It's 8 minutes before 2 o'clock, and settlement prices are in from the Chicago Board of Trade. What happened in the end today, Todd?
It was a rough day in the end for the corn and the beans and for the wheat as well. Even over on the Mercantile Exchange, as you'll tell the folks in just a bit, Celeste, that it was a tough day. There on the Merc last night, of course, the second inconclusive finding in the last 4 or 5 days of a BSE potentially positive cow here in the United States. That released last night at about 5:15 p.m. Eastern Time by USDA, and that pushed the market there lower. At the Chicago Board of Trade, USDA in action as well. The June 30th acreage reports and the quarterly stocks report for June 1st were out. Those showed some numbers that the trade didn't like very much for the beans in the quarterly stocks report and for the beans and the corn both in the acreage reports. In fact, if you take the acreage number that the USDA released for corn this morning and multiply it out, and this would be the harvested acreage times the 145 bushel average they are expecting, at least at this time, you end up with a 10.6 billion bushel corn crop, and that pushed the market lower. Let's begin in the wheat pit. July, 340, the high, the low at 328, settled 338. They were up a half cent. September on out, lower though, 347, the high, the low at 337 and a half, settled 345 and a half, a penny and three quarters lower in December contract, 358 and a half, the high. Low at 350 and a quarter, settled 357 and a quarter, down 3 cents. March futures 368, the high, the low at 361 and a half, settled 367, down 2 3/4. In the May wheat futures, 371, the high, the low at 366, settlement price at 370, down 2.5 cents. By the way, during the closing market report today, we're going to forego the news segment, and we'll simply stay with analysis of what's been happening at the Chicago Board of Trade. We'll talk with Paul Cooley first of all, and then you'll hear an interview that I did about 11 o'clock this morning with Daryl Good for 9 minutes or so, followed that up with Kay Whitlock. So stay with us during the closing market report. Should be interesting. July corn now, 10.5 cents lower on the day. 262 the high, the low at 254 and a half, settlement price at 257 and a half. Corn futures gapping down on the open, by the way. September futures 268 the high, low at 260, settled 262 and a half, down a dime. December contract 271 the high, the low at 264 and 3/4, bouncing off the low up to 267 on the settlement price, 10 and a half cents lower. And the March contract 278 high, low at 272 and a quarter, settled 273 and 3/4. They were down a dime. May contract 282 and a half, the high, the low at 277 and a half, settled 279 and 3/4, down 9 1/4. In July futures, 285 and a half, the high, the low at 280 and 3/4, settled 281 and a half, down 9 3/4. September contract 277 and a half, the high, the low at 272 and a half, settled on that low at 272 and a half for the Septembers of next year, down 6 1/4. And December futures 267 and a quarter, the high, the low 264. December 2005 corn settled 264 and a quarter. They were down 2 3/4 on the day. July oats 136 and a quarter, high, low at 131 and a half, settled 132 and 3/4, down 7. And September's 142 and 3/4 high, low at 137 and a half, settlement price at 139, and they were 6.5 cents lower on the day. From the soy complex, bean futures, the nearby July contract, just a penny and a half lower at the end of the day, had a high today of 898, a pretty good spread, down to 864 for the low, settlement price closer to that high end at 893, down 1.5 in the July beans. That stocks figure at 410 million on the high end of trade expectations, but very, very short still. August contract now, 805 the high, the low at 760, settled 782 and a half. They were down 23 and a half cents despite being an old crop. Most believe that the Delta region will be harvesting beans at that time, and August contract will look more like a new crop. September futures, 723 the high, the low at 686, settled 697, 29 and a half lower. November down 30 and three quarters today. 698 the high, the low at 660 and a half. Came up off that low to settle at 669, down 30 and three quarters. January, 692 high, low at 664, settled 669, 33 and a half lower in the March soybeans. 690 the high, the low at 663, settled 671 and a half, down 28 and a half. And the May contract, 675 the high, the low at 655, settled 664, down 27 for the day. July bean meal now 298.50 high, low at 280.50, settled 297.50. That meal contract up 420. August 274 the high, the low at 258, settled 271.80, and they were down 2. July bean oil 28.90 high, low at 28.15, settled 28.18, down 57. And the August contract for the bean oil, 28.05, the high, the low at 27.15, settled 27.19, down 74 on the day. Now here's Celeste with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. Celeste?
Okay, Todd. August feeder cattle, 110.95, the high, 109.02 and a half, the low, 109.40, the settlement, that down 262 and a half. September, 109.50, the high, 107.55, the low, 108.45, the settlement, that down 207 and a half. October, 107.60, the high, 105.55, the low, 106.70, the settlement, that down 165. June live cattle, 89 even, the high, 87 even, the low, 87.25, the settlement, that down 155. July, 87 even, the high, 85.80, the low, 87 even, the settlement, that down 150. August, 86.25, the high, 84.87 and a half, the low, 85.75, the settlement, that down 212 and a half. July lean hog, 79.20, the high, 77.70, the low, the final price, 78.95, that up 145. August, 76.92 and a half, the high, 75.70, the low, 76.70, the settlement, that up 82 and a half. October, 66.30, the high, 65.15 the low, 66.10 the settlement, that up 60. December lean hog, 60.90 the high, 60.15 the low, the settlement, 60.82 and a half, that up 32 and a half. July pork bellies, 116.90 the high, the low, 116 even, the settlement, 116.27 and a half, that down 67 and a half. The Dow now up 24 points at 10,438. The NASDAQ up 8 at 2043. The S&P 500 3 higher at 1140.
Agricultural information is made possible in part by a grant from the Archer Daniels Midland Company. ADM, the nature of what's to come.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Stephen P. Statton from Bloomington, Minnesota writes, Dear Dr. Science, why is the alphabet in that order?
It's because of the song. Never underestimate the music industry's effect on the rest of us. Some Tin Pan Alley hack writes a catchy tune, and